Did Proust have it right? Does food, whether it's a Madeleine from an aristocratic childhood or the Velveeta mac and cheese my mom used to make, have a special significance for our memory, perhaps even our very being? In his new book, The Omnivorous Mind, Our Evolving Relationship to Food, neuroanthropologist John S. Allen takes up this question by guiding us into the inner structures of the brain, into the hippocampus and amygdala, where memories and emotions mix and where food plays a surprising role. But Allen's book doesn't just journey into the brain. It travels back in time to the origins of modern humanity, showing us how our evolutionary past shapes our eating present. Along the way, we learn about the eating habits of Neanderthals and chimpanzees. We discover the benefits of being omnivores and even super omnivores. And we investigate why a food quality as seemingly straightforward as crispiness makes our mouths water. Here's a hint. The exoskeletons of insects might have something to do with our love of Colonel Sanders' extra crispy recipe. Please join us for a discussion of how and why we eat that begins millions of years ago and ends every time we sit down at the table with our 1,400 cc's of human brain. John, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great to be here.
I'm looking so forward to talking with you about this book, The Omnivorous Mind, Our Evolving Relationship with Food, which is fascinating and reader-friendly and just the kind of book that fits so well in your hand while you're in the kitchen waiting for something to simmer. And you're suddenly finding yourself in the middle of the hypothalamus. But before I do that, I'd just like you to introduce yourself to us. Tell us a little bit about how perhaps you came to this project or what drew you to food, as well as your work as an anthropologist and neuroscientist.
Well, that's a big question. I am an anthropologist, a biological anthropologist with some broader training. And then over the years, I've kind of drifted from a more behavioral focus to a neuroanatomy, but always have had a sort of an interest in food. I've had students do sort of food related topics in the past, graduate students. And so I've sort of stayed in it. And this is books, the result of a kind of lifelong interest in food. I'm a very enthusiastic, home cook and so on. I come from a background. My mother was Japanese. My father was American and my mother was an excellent cook. And so I think she influenced me there. She could cook Japanese food or American food equally well. And so, you know, this book's sort of the culmination of both personal and professional interests, and I wanted to share it. Just like when you have a sort of excess of food, I thought I had an excess of thinking about food or a food thought, so I was happy to share it, and I hope people enjoy it, and it helps them understand their food and enjoy their food and eating more.
Well, and it seems as though one of the problems that does come up in the book is the problem of excess. What happens when you have a tremendous amount of food? And I'm thinking that in a few days, there are going to be children all across America dressed up as ghouls and goblins and who knows what, collecting an excess of sugared candy. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, what do you see when you see all those kids scampering around the neighborhood gathering an excess of candy?
Well, excess is an interesting thing because one thing you see is people having experiences that they're going to remember. I mean, they may all run together, but I think anyone who's gone trick-or-treating, any American child who was able to do it, you know, you do have that kind of fond recollection. But one of the things I think that's probably forgotten is that bag of the leftovers found a month or two later of all that candy you never got around to eating or you didn't want to eat. So that's not, and you know, and someone, your mother or father picks it up and tosses it. And so, you know, that aspect of it is not the memorable aspect, but all that anticipation of that sweet food, which is sweetness clearly in our evolutionary past as a primate, was something that was very attractive because it's associated with ripe fruit and so on. It wasn't something that you were ever going to find in abundance all the time. You might find it seasonally in abundance. And so all that is sort of working together to make the whole experience, besides dressing up and all that, the food, the dressing up, makes it really memorable. But the excess part, I mean, you might remember the excess consumption, which of course then works against it. But it's funny, I think dealing with that huge amount has a part that's not nearly as memorable as all that anticipation.
And so what role does anticipation play in, say, how we form memories about food?
Well, anticipation, well, there are all sorts of cues that go on about diet that relate the brain and the gut and hormones that connect those sorts of things. And some of those clearly I shouldn't say clearly because it's very complicated and still getting worked out, but do relate to parts of the brains like the hippocampus that do affect memory directly. And those hippocampus also has intimate connections to parts of the brain that have to do with emotions such as the amygdala. And so we find that food is really a thing at the intersection of all these different systems in the brain that are related to memory. And that's not terribly surprising because one of the most important things any animal can do is remember where they got their last meal and where to help them get their next one. And so memory and food are related. And then if you take our own sort of enhancements, our cognitive enhancements, all that higher level stuff that's going on in this expanded brain that we have, you know, we actually tend to intensify those things. And then even to extend it further, and which is why some of these things get quite complicated, is that we make food a very social thing. We make the learning about food a social activity, and where you get it, how you prepare it, who you eat it with. And again, it all sort of snowballs there into a very intensive memory experience. And then you take these special occasions. Thanksgiving is one that's coming up, the Halloween coming up more recently, any sort of feast. All that becomes very evocative.
So one of the things about your book is it seems that it hits food from just about every physiological and social angle that anyone can imagine. I mean, if you're interested in food, you're going to come across a passage that's going to speak directly to you. Before we move on from memory, and no doubt we'll circle back to it at some point, I want to ground what you've been saying in maybe one of the most famous food passages of all time. And so there's that passage in Proust's great, you know, Remembrance of Lost Time, in which he eats the Madeleine and he has the tea and everything comes back. Is food special in regard to memory? Does it have a special place? Was Proust right in those 8,000 pages or whatever it turned out to be, that food is sort of a key to understanding memory and culture? You certainly show how it works. I'm just wondering, does it have a special place for us?
I think it does. And I think it does relate back to this deep evolutionary past. It's just that there are certain things that, you know, any animal, not just people animals, need to survive. And you need to be able to get food, and you need to be able to find mates, ultimately, to reproduce. So those sorts of things are very basic and very important. Now, over the course of primate evolution and human evolution, as I said, we've elaborated on these things. But at the core there, that connection between food and memory and food and emotion, potentially, or food and other things, is there all over the place. And in fact, it gets to be one of those things that when you start to try to separate them and tease out these strands, you actually are undoing the whole thing, and it can be kind of misleading in its own way. But so I think Proust was onto something there. As I discuss in the book, I discuss my memory of discussing Proust. That's how powerful his insight was in the class, my comp lit class, some 30 whatever plus years ago.
Well, if you make it through that book, that certainly is a memorable experience.
We only went through Swan's Way, I think.
Well, you mentioned this idea of looking at eating as a deep evolutionary past, and you have this line in your book, "We eat with our brains." And I'm wondering, for somebody who doesn't naturally default to that perspective, what does it mean to begin looking at human behavior and food ways from that sort of vantage point? I mean, most of the foodies that I know don't begin their food histories 2.5 million years ago. And that's a touchstone for you. And then it's a million, you know, 1.5 million for the beginning of cooking. So what's it like to approach questions about eating from that perspective?
Well, it can be, it does give you a the kind of levels of appreciation, I think. I think if you eat something and you like it, you can think about, well, why, you can ask them the question is why. And I think that's when we get into the time depth of evolution or also of your cultural background. Both of these things are at play here. You say, why do I like this? And that's why the first chapter I talk about crispy stuff, crispy foods and crunchy foods. And the basic, that was at me asking that question. Well, why do I like potato chips so much? Or why, you know, why is extra crispy Kentucky Fried Chicken better than just crispy Kentucky Fried Chicken? Or, but then conversely, why don't I like to eat this bug that's walking across my table now? And so if you start thinking about those things in depth, you actually, I think you learn a little about yourself if you actually consider that sort of depth of time. And you can go, don't have to go back 2 million years all the time. You could go back, you know, 20 years or 10 years and think about, well, what's my own history with this food? And then ultimately your own history, though, encompasses both your cultural history and your biological history.
Well, tell us a little bit why you like those potato chips, because the book opens with this tour de force on crispiness, mm-hmm. in which you show, I think, and showcase your methodology. So what yes. is it about that potato chip rather than that bug? Because that bug is crispy.
It is. And I do think, you know, the potato one is why, I mean, there's a, then this has been a broad anthropological question is why don't the Western cuisines like bugs in general? I mean, that's a specific question. But if we go back, there are lots of other cuisines where bugs are eaten. No one loves, I don't think bugs are never the first choice, right? I mean, no mammal with our kind of physiology could survive on bugs unless we went the anteater route and just had, you know, we're able to tap into huge quantities. And even then, our digestive systems aren't really set up for all that hard exoskeleton of the bug. So, I mean, so that's one issue there. But if we go back and think, well, what is good? What's out there that besides bugs, and bugs are out there, that's for sure, that's crispy. And one thing would be lots of sort of crispy plant materials, leaves, stalks, and so on. And some primates, like a big gorilla and some kinds of monkeys, that's what they kind of make their living on. But our kind don't. We'd rather eat rice, ripe fruits that are sweet and softer. But we can, our kind, let's say, can survive on, can get something out of those. So again, we get to this idea that these crispy foods are fallback foods. So maybe bugs, maybe crispy stalks and so on, they don't have the things that we like most. They don't have the taste, the sweet taste or so and so on. They don't have that kind of fatty thing, which also seems to be very appealing to us. But, you know, they fill you up, they get you something, and maybe the crispiness is something that makes them more attractive, right? And when we say that they're attractive, for some reason, that means that whoever found those things would be willing to eat them, as opposed to their primary. So fallback foods, crispiness may be part of that. Now, what we have today, of course, and this comes in with cooking, is the ability to create crispy in substances that never had it. So so that you could get a crust on meat. You can soften things too, like tubers, but you can also crisp them up, and caramelization on the surface is something that creates sweetness, which is something we're already ready for, or the fatty feel. And so a potato chip, for example, then becomes sort of just a vehicle for carrying fattiness, that oily flavor, you know, that's part of it, having been deep fried, or saltiness, which we also have a sort of baseline appeal for as well. So crispy, if it was something that maybe was once originally not a primary thing, combined though now today with these primary preferences and available in excess, that becomes sort of the for many people, a kind of ultimate food.
Yes, you attribute perhaps one of the origins of the book that you wrote to Mario Batali.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I said, you know, that's where I originally started thinking about, because I've read this not just from his stuff, but he says something about, you know, you put crispy in a menu title, or you have the server sit there in a fancier restaurant who's rattling off descriptions of things, and you throw the word crispy in, or Kentucky Fried Chicken up there on the sign above the order counter, that they know crispy moves food. And this, of course, isn't a shock, but I mean, it's a word that can work in a menu, and it can work in other settings. And I also talk about how crispy foods are often sort of gateway foods for transferring foods from culture to culture. I mean, we in the U.S., we eat Japanese food such as sushi, but some of the earlier foods that people that don't want to go right to the soft raw fish would be a tonkatsu, which is a deep fried pork cutlet, or a tempura, which would be, you know, fried vegetables in a batter. Now, so that would be sort of the gateway food to sushi. But what's interesting is that both of those treatments of food are themselves cultural borrowings into Japan. And so we see that crispy foods, such as chips and so on, are something that crosses cultural boundaries as well.
And in the opening, it's so fascinating because, in fact, I want to take a shot at kind of describing what it would be like to be an anthropologist and a neuroscientist, because it seems as though you take this transcultural phenomenon like crispiness that's transported itself around the globe, and that becomes a kind of problem. And then the way you begin solving it is just fascinating. So maybe there's this primary source of food in sweetness. Maybe that's it. Maybe there are these fallback foods in insects or in, you know, vegetables. And then maybe cooking comes along and allows you to do more of that, and you can wet it to things like fats. And then you go into, well, maybe it's onomatopoeia. Maybe the very word crispy can trigger certain sorts of associations of eating it. And, you know, you go into the MRI studies where imagining and doing a particular motor skill have some overlaps, though not always. And then suddenly you talk about habituation and how people seek variety. And so the fact that this is, you know, going off in your ear as well as your mouth might be part of its appeal.
I was thinking about that the other day. I was, you know, I was watching some, this was, you know, some football game or something, and I had a big bowl of popcorn. And by the time I crunched my way through it, all that was left was the sound in terms of my sensory, you know, perception of it. I had stopped tasting corn or salt or whatever, but the crunchiness was keeping me going. So, I mean, in some ways, you know, that's another advantage. If you want to think of the crispy foods competing with other foods, that's another advantage for me to keep on with it.
Well, so do you think it's pleasure, it's survival? You have this very interesting phrase that I had not come across before in all my food reading called a foodgasm.
I've seen that. And so I kind of looked into that. Yeah.
So I have to ask on behalf of listeners now, what's a foodgasm?
Well, foodgasm, which, you know, I've seen it used this way, and I think this is when you eat something, you have a very strong reaction to it. And so that people have termed that kind of, oh, wow, that's so great, you know, initial reaction to eating something. They've called that a foodgasm. Now, of course, that's a somewhat right there. It's the opposite of an orgasm, because orgasm comes at the end, but the foodgasm is the beginning. And so all this tension of anticipation, I think that's a really important thing. It's you're not going to have the foodgasm on the 100th bite of popcorn, no matter how good it is. Probably if you're already sated anyway, you're not going to have a foodgasm. In that way, maybe it's similar to an orgasm. But that anticipation is really critical to that. And some of the taste part of the orbital frontal cortex, interestingly enough, where a lot of sort of taste integration in the brain takes place, is also an area where that's activated during orgasm. So this sort of sated tension release thing, there may be some neurological overlap between a foodgasm and an orgasm.
So let me just ask a very naive question. Is the brain just a little bit messy? You know, it can't separate sex from food. It can't separate what it's supposed to remember from what it smells. And it just kind of gets all in a jumble.
Yes, I think, you know, neuroscientists, when they investigate pathways, or they investigate activations, you know, those blobs that you see, you know, that say, oh, look at this part of the brain lit up during this task. You know, you want the whole point, a good experiment simplifies all the variables, simplifies everything so you can see your effect and where you're looking at it. But of course, when you have that sort of functional task in the brain. The whole brain's lighting up. Different parts are doing something. That's why you have to think up tasks that show the contrast between two different states, and then you can statistically manipulate them and say, "Oh, we've seen the difference between these two states, and that's the activation." But there's a lot of overlap. There are a lot of different networks that are developed. Maybe networks that are more powerful develop when you're younger over the course of development as you're growing. But these networks can be retrained in adulthood. It's harder and harder as you get older. And you're certainly creating new ones as you go older. I mean, I've done research on brain aging. And, all these studies about sort of staving off dementia have to do with people keeping their brains active. And that indicates, again, there's some sort of plasticity going on that you can, it is effective to some extent. And some of this sort of, and one thing I bring in sort of towards the end of the book is I'd like to see that if we say that, and just reading or that kind of intellectual activity is good for dementia, or maintaining social relationships, a social life, an active social life is good for staving off that sort of brain decay, that I would suspect that food preparation, having responsibility for what you eat yourself, is a kind of relationship that could also be, should be encouraged in the aging, and that in itself is maybe one of those ways that we keep our brain activity going longer.
Well, I have a mother that both consumes fish oil because she thinks it's going to help her memory and loves to cook. So this is a good recommendation for her.
Yeah.
Well, you do. Speaking of the messiness of the brain, there's a large portion of the book that deals with categorizing food and the importance of making those distinctions. Could you tell us a little bit about how that works and why it's so important?
Well, categories, I bring this up. Categories, when you label something, it's a way that gets your way. It's a shorthand way for your brain to access that. And so, you could have knowledge, implicit knowledge about all sorts of things. And that implicit knowledge is really important in lots of different ways that you don't think about. But to make that implicit explicit gives you a way to grab a handle. And the one thing I sort of wonder about or speculate about is that when you get these sort of, when the government, various governments all over the world do this, they try to recommend a diet. I mean, they don't call it, but they don't want to call it a diet because they said, this is the government diet. Everyone should eat everything this way because all the nutritional scientists say this is what we should be eating. And of course, what's irritating to people is those change over time. But they don't want to call it a diet because diets give it a name, and a diet almost by definition is sort of labeling this change. When we say a diet, we mean a change. We're changing from however we want to eat, which is implicit and was learned as you grew up, to something different to change the way you are. And so they don't want to call it a diet, so they make a picture, right? A food pyramid. Or a pagoda in some Asian countries, or a pie chart, or a plate. It's a plate. It's never pie. There's never a pie part in the recommended diet. In Japan, a spinning top. So all these things are sort of kind of, I think, trying to kind of run around this labeling, this explicit labeling of the diet. Now, on the other hand, if you become a vegan and you come from a different band, that you think there's some enlightenment there. I think these diets you do want to label it because in effect you are advertising both to yourself and to others. I've found a new way, and so you want to say I'm a vegan, I'm a vegetarian, I'm on this diet or that diet, even if it's just a weight loss diet. And so those are I call it something, I say, this is enlightenment. And I mean, it really is. It's lighting a bulb in your brain that puts food into the spotlight in the way that in the past, in our evolutionary past, just never was an option, right? In the past, you ate what was available, perhaps, or you ate the way your people ate or the way your family ate. There was no putting a name on it necessarily if you never had to.
And when you turn to diets, You draw a... Well, I think you give us one of the best answers as to why diets are so hard to follow, even when they're self-chosen, when you, much less government-imposed, right? When you do have a moment of enlightenment, you think, I'm going to go vegan, or I'm going to go pescatarian, or whatever it turns out to be. And it has to do with this notion you have of an implicit theory of food that each of us carries around. And you liken it to a language.
Yeah, I think... And I think that as you're growing, and as I don't, I think, and again, in a way, this is a, just an example of that giving a name to something. I think we're all sort of aware of that, right? Oh, I eat the way I grew up. You know, how else would you eat? I mean, that's sort of commonsensical. But by saying this is your theory of food is to sort of give you an, you know, opens your eyes to the fact that, yes, it isn't your way you eat has a developmental trajectory. It's very powerful in your brain, you know, in your mind, in terms of how your mind is structured, because it was being laid down by people who with whom you have a very significant relationship, your family usually. And all these things are very similar to language. Now, step back and say, okay, I want to learn a new language. Let me kill that clock. That's not the easiest thing in the world, right? And so we all can understand, especially when you're older, that, you know, it's very hard to change the way the language you speak. It's not impossible. Some people will do it more easily than others. Some people will do it repeatedly. But it's not an easy thing, and it is something that's very much part of your cognitive being.
Yes, I just imagine what it would be like if it was understood, you know, the diet gurus come out and they say do this or try that, that each time you were being asked that, it's not that different from being asked to learn French if you don't speak it, or Japanese if you don't speak it, as opposed to, you know, there seems to be this kind of default, well, if I just will it, it will change.
Yes. Excuse me, go ahead.
Oh, I think that language is a wonderful way to bring out what you talk about when you talk about food as a biocultural phenomenon. So I'm going to get it wrong, but I just want to see if I can articulate it. And I hope you'll correct me when I get it wrong. Oh. But it's that there's this sort of innate biological potential, a language instinct to acquire a language, but which particular language you acquire is going to depend on your cultural circumstances. And you're making a similar claim for food that, you know, human beings need to eat. There are certain dispositions that are predetermined by your biology. But then culture grafts that and shapes it. And it suddenly starts to feel pretty rigid.
Yes. And how it grabs it. I mean, and then it, you know, then the brain is ready to be trained in a way. It's like, you know, there's lots of debates about how, you know, the core of language and things like universal grammar, especially this picked up quite a bit lately. But nonetheless, I think it's quite clear that the brain itself is very adept at learning language, spoken language. And I think it's very adept as well at developing a theory of food. I think there'd be a lot of good, you know, sort of selectionist reasons for that. You know, it's important to have food, just like it's important to be able to talk. Now, beyond that, I think we get back to the sort of messy brain. This is going to involve a lot of different networks. And I'm not sure at this point we really understand in a neurological way how those networks are modified and laid down. I suspect that they're there. And there are some biases in creating certain types of networks, like for language. But other than that, it isn't necessarily a hard, you know, it's funny. It's the whole biocultural is to get away from saying, oh, it's hardwired or softwired, or it's hardware or software. You know, it's a combination of the two. And it's really best to try to look at it that way at all times, instead of getting kind of, when we get ultimately nature nurture sort of dichotomies aren't that useful.
I think one of the virtues of your book is that I never feel like you're oversimplifying problems. So when you take something like the senses and eating and what it is to have a sensual experience of eating, you begin with, you know, the question of why it is that the French might be more inclined to do so. And suddenly you're talking about Napoleon. And then in the next moment, you're talking about what's going on in the center of our brain and our, you know, chemoreceptors. So I'm curious, do you... I would love to know what kinds of studies that you feel you'd like to see in the future. You've kind of give this vast survey of all these fascinating studies in the book, and you just said this provocative thing that we don't quite perhaps understand it fully. So if you had, you know, a huge grant that you could bestow for a project, what would you want to test? What would you want to find out next?
Well, I mean, the people are starting to do this, although it's becoming it's just starting to take out. Is some of this sort of the cultural effects of functional brain on cultural effects on brain function in terms of just these sort of pathways we've been talking about? I mean, that's a very basic question, really, if you're trying to answer these higher level issues. But it's sort of, you need to have that first, at least as a starting point. And we're starting, it's done a little bit, but you have to keep in mind as we're still very early in functional imaging and so on. And a lot of that work was dedicated to getting rid of variation, getting rid of individual variation, because you wanted to get statistical power, and you got to do things that way, or cultural variation. You have to get rid of some of that variation to try to get the signal through the noise. But to some extent, the noise that has to do with culture or your different upbringings and so on, that's where the interesting stuff starts to come in. So you see some of that variability, people looking at, say, in various, obviously lots of different psychiatric conditions and so on. So people do that. But, we need to get a bigger picture on what the variation is in quote normal brain function. Beyond that, at a even more cultural level, it'd be nice to really get more in depth about feelings of food. I mean, that's something I've been thinking about. That's sort of in other projects, is how people feel about food. How do they deal with their feelings? Because feelings is an area that is also just sort of starting to get more grounded, and it's something that works at an implicit level. So how we feel about things is obviously a influences how we think about things. And so how do you feel about food and so on? So, that's sort of a quick answer to that.
Well, I'm sure that there are all sorts of ways you could go. I just want to circle back to some of the studies that you're talking about. So, for example, you bring up studies that happen in MRI machines. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you point out is just a very practical thing that you can't really have people doing all sorts of movements in there. And that's one of the things that we want to study. But you also get your evidence from the fossil record. Mm. And it's not every food book that will talk about the shape of the brain pan and the size of the brain. 1,400 cc's of brain really changes the way you eat. How does it change the way you eat?
Well, the bottom line in all these sort of old neurological, evolutionary issues is that that neurological tissue is what we could say is expensive. It takes a lot of energy to run, and so there's plenty of evidence. An interesting study has you think about how things you learn from all sorts of weird stuff. Someone did a fruit fly study, and people have been raising fruit flies for hundreds of generations in labs, and they actually compared over fruit fly colony, they've been going for decades, and they looked at them, and they're actually finding that their eyes are getting smaller, more or less. And eyes are neurologic. If you want to see your brain, look in the mirror and look in your eyes, because those have direct connection to the brain, as much direct as anything that's brought to the surface. And they don't, they're not using their vision as much, haven't been for hundreds of generations to find their food. They haven't had to. So there's actually been a sort of a loss of investment in that expensive tissue, whatever else, something else is going on there, but they've quit investing so much in expensive neurological tissue. And so people have looked at this in primates and lots of other animals, and you see, ultimately, we have to find a way to feed a big brain. And we have brains that are three times as large, more or less, than the great apes, who are our closest relatives. And most of this increase is only we've been separate from as a evolutionary lineage from the apes for 5 or 6 million years. But it's only been in the last couple million years that you find fossils that where they start to get a bigger brain. And so people try to link that to tools, and something's happening also with diet, perhaps, because the teeth are also getting very generalized. They're not nothing specialized there in our teeth. That may have to do with feeding that brain or having a brain that allows you to exploit new food sources. It's a little bit hard to figure out. You know, there's obviously a feedback where it starts. It's hard to say. Now, people have said cooking may have been an important thing. That would be an interesting thing, is to really figure out, you know, what's the evidence for cooking that would really be satisfying. And when we go back that far, you know, if it's more recent and you can find a living floor and it's an obvious fire hearth, archaeologists are good at saying, okay, that was a fire there and that fire was made by people. Now, when you go back a million years, you don't find such nice, neat places. You don't find nice cave sites where you can see where the fire was and so on. And so it does get a little harder, and that would be nice to be able to resolve when maybe cooking came into the picture. I mean, but we do see that our relatives get out of Africa and they're going to a lot of different climates, and some of them would seem pretty cold. And, you know, the use of fire could start with thawing food. If you were somewhere where the food had, you know, something had died and frozen, and you want to get at it. But so that's a interesting issue. But it all comes down to the brain size thing comes down to feeding and growing a big, energetically expensive brain.
Well, I think in that answer, you've taken us close to your title, and I just want to make sure that we do justice to the book by doing the title, because you started to talk about, you know, our omnivorous nature, mm-hmm. and the title is The Omnivorous Mind. Mm-hmm. So if somebody naively asked, you know, John, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean?
Well, I'd say again that people are, and I actually wind up calling people super omnivores, because it isn't just about the fact that we eat lots of different things, which is true. As a species, if you look, you know, across what people eat, we really do eat a remarkable variety of foodstuffs. And if we were to go back pre-agriculturally, that still holds true. Agriculture is actually kind of, and especially within cultures, has narrowed probably the foods that we've eaten, that people have relied on.
And you nicely point out some near ancestors of ours that specialized and even developed.
Oops, there goes the phone. Oh.
That'll get edited out.
That's all right. Yep. Go ahead.
Nope, that's no problem. I'm just going to mark down the time so that the producers have a guess. Okay. So I just wanted to jump in and say that you point out some near ancestors of ours who developed different sorts of jaws mm-hmm. that didn't specialize and didn't seem to do as well as a result of that.
Well, yeah, or they did. They over-specialized. The robust Australopithecines. They come off on our lineage. I mean, they're more closely related to us, almost without doubt, than any of us. Them are related to other apes. They're bipedal. They're walking along too. They're very good bipeds. In fact, they could walk by on two legs. You know, I would look out your window and imagine one walking by on two legs, and you wouldn't sit there we wouldn't notice that there was like a chimpanzee or a gorilla sort of, you know, with a tottering walk. It would be a very good bipedal walk. Now you get to their heads, and they call them robust. They're not very large body, but their jaws are enormous. Their jaws and teeth are enormous. And almost of the all the teeth are, it's the back teeth, the molars. The front teeth are extremely small. So here this is something that's evolved as we have evolved from something that would look very ape-like, you know, fairly large teeth, big canine, sort of generalized teeth, to really tiny front teeth and huge molars. And so they go one way and we go our way, and you can look in your mouth and we have small teeth. We have, at this point, we have small jaws. We've had a lot of reduction, but we don't have that. Our mouth doesn't have that kind of specialization, our teeth. And so these guys stayed in Africa. They evolved. They had a nice run there for a million years or 2 million years or so. There's different versions of them. But they clearly were working on, foods. Used to say that they thought they were concentrating on seeds, but probably grasses as well. And it just was a direction that allowed them, you know, they could probably still eat fruit, some expansion, but it wasn't the true omnivory that we went into, our lineage. And so they go extinct. Maybe we helped them along, because one thing that's clear that happens for us is an increased reliance on meat. Now, how much it is or how little is debated, but we clearly start taking advantage of our ability to kill and eat and butcher, maybe more importantly, animals. And we butcher animals, our ancestors anyway, didn't use their teeth to butcher them. They were using stone tools. So chimpanzees hunt fairly, you know, they hunt, they like to hunt, they like meat. But their problem is that without tools to butcher, and they can kill plenty of smaller things, and they cooperatively hunt, and they'll share meat. They do. They have a lot of meat-related behavior, but and they have to start ripping it apart with their teeth and their hands. And, you know, after they've eaten the soft stuff, the brains and the various organs, they don't do a very good job on the muscle. So our advantage is we start, again, to take it to expand our diet. We develop probably technological ways to eat more of an animal. So not only to kill them and larger ones more efficiently, but to actually take advantage of that. And cooking is then one idea that would make that protein more available.
So does that what you mean when you say we go from omnivorous to super omnivorous? What's that leap there? I'm not imagining people eating with capes and, you know, spandex outfits.
Yeah. No, that's the beginning of kind of a true omnivory for our kind. But I say the super omnivory comes in when we introduce a strong cultural component. And by that, I mean, it becomes important. It's clear when you look at what people do, what you don't eat is as important as what you do eat. And it became what people eat became very closely tied to cultural identity. So in many places, you know, you can have two ethnic groups side by side, and they'll define each other as much as anything by, oh, we eat this stuff. Those guys over there, you know, they're crazy. They eat that, even though it's all edible. And anybody could survive on it. But for social identity and social cohesion, food becomes a player there. And that's what really contributes to the super omnivory. That and the fact that going back to the animals, we did start to get an ability to kill really big things too, at some point, and much more than anybody could ever, any person or family, small family could ever eat in a setting. So sharing, feasting, these sorts of, social relationships around food, could be very beneficial and also, you know, very binding. And so, that's the beginning of super omnivory, that kind of thing.
And again, I would say that's a virtue of the book, is that I always feel as though the biological and the cultural, you're keeping them in a happy and productive tension as you move forward. Another example of that you just glanced upon is disgust. Mm. And you give a nice account of how that's not just a cultural phenomenon, but there it does indeed include a physical gut somatic response to certain sorts of actions and foods and even words that are triggered.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, people who study, I mean, disgust is something we all, anybody could feel it about a food item that is either, it may be rotten, you know, all these sort or, you know, not as dead as you'd like it to be, or, you know, any upbringing, you're going to have some food items that you're going to recoil from. And you have that reaction, you know, but without thinking, it's a very disgust sort of base action. And then a lot of psychologists looking at this, how this sort of feeling gets transferred then to ideas, at least in us. And then this is part of, again, this cognitive elaboration. We have ideas that are disgusting, or scenarios, or thoughts, or possibilities. And those are seen as disgusting now. But it's probably at some basic level all working off the same neurological equipment. And so, you know, food, maybe that's one reason the food and cultural identity becomes quite powerful, because others do that, while we do this. And if we bring food into that sort of equation of identity, then we're tapping something really basic.
Well, let's talk about a particular Western and also Northern European mm-hmm. thing that we do, which you have a very interesting take on, which is the problem of obesity. And you have a nice account of the condition that's perhaps contributing to that. And I just wonder if you'd share that with us.
well, we live in this sort of world of food excess, right? And everything that we've done in the past has been sort of, if there is a harder aspect to all this, it's for dealing with food that isn't so excessively available. And so when we get into this environment of, and it isn't even, it's a world, this same thing sort of happens. This obesity epidemic really isn't an epidemic in the sense that, you know, it's going to hit developing countries and so on, because cheap, easily accessible food is something that does become available with a relatively low level of development and becomes accessible to people at all socioeconomic levels. So this is a major problem, but it's clear that we're not really, our bodies and our minds as that relate to body. And in a sense, if we want to say, don't separate biological and cultural, you know, see them as entwined, then we really need to see body and mind also more so as co-players. And so we get this idea, which people relate to a lot of other different areas, but, you know, we really aren't adapted for this environment. And it is an environment that it is our bodies telling us that, you know, sweet is good and fatty is good. But obviously when it's too much available, then it isn't so good. If you want to live a long time, it isn't that terrible. This is one of the things about obesity. An excess of food will get you grown up. It'll get you to reproductive age. It'll get you through quite a chunk of what we think of as a normal lifespan. But if you want to live better and longer, it does. There's a big cost there.
Well, John, it's been great to hear about the book. I can't recommend it enough.
Well, thank you very much for saying that.
I'm very excited to hear where you might be going next.
Well, I'd like to think, I mean, I always think about food, and I'd love to be in a position to write more about food. If enough people read this book, I suppose I would be. As of late, I've been thinking a lot more about feelings and in our, again, sort of in an everyday life, what is underlying these complex sort of feelings about home and place in particular. I'm trying to relate these sort of global things about our everyday lives to our pasts and to our histories. And so that's sort of what I'm doing these days.
Is there some trigger in the way that Crispy got you going or Mario Batali got you going on this book that's getting you to think in this direction?
I'm not sure. I mean, that's a good question. Something triggered it. And I don't know where the feeling of thinking about feelings came from in this case. So.
Well, how does an anthropologist and neuroscientist think about feelings? What's a feeling for you? You know, for me, who's somebody in the literary world, it's, you know, something inflected with aesthetics and emotionality. What's a feeling from your disciplinary perspective?
Well, the feeling is, and I'm following from I work with Antonio and Hannah Damasio at University of Southern California, and I've for several years, and they really promoted Antonio very much the idea of this sort of mind brain connection. And so to some extent, the most basic thing is that connecting, that connection that is in many, sometimes explicit. It relates, you know, the way it explodes into your conscious cognition is through emotion. And you say you become aware of this emotion or that emotion, and that sort of feelings writ large. But what goes on in terms of your everyday life and maintaining a certain balance in your life, either behaviorally or physically, are all these other feelings that are going on. And to some extent, the feeling of well-being is almost by definition a non-problem. And yet it's governing what we're doing now, or, you know, if you're sort of, feeling okay about things or feeling, you know, it's not an issue, but it's there maintaining your balance in life. And so I think, you know, food does relate to that because, you know, when everything's fine and every food is there, and it's okay and all and so on, you don't really necessarily think about it. It's all part of moving along through life. So,
yes, your book ends with the idea that, you know, the theories of food we have are these implicit cognitive theories mm-hmm. that we've used. So it sounds also like we have an implicit kind of state of well-being that we're not aware of, but that guides our behavior.
Exactly. And I think but then in a sort of, you know thyself, which is, I think, sort of underlying all of anthropology, if you know, we think of humans as a thing worth studying and knowing, you know, I think you can do better by being aware of it, being aware of food, theory of food, where your food world, how it develops and where it comes from. I mean, almost by definition, I have to believe that that should help you enjoy your food, enjoy your eating life. I mean, it's sort of my whole, what I've done all my life is understanding where we came from as a species helps me understand where we are today. And so hopefully understanding where and how you eat today either will make you a better eater for whatever it is you think of as being better, or at least to enjoy what you're doing with food more than you did in the past.
Well, your book is certainly a contribution to doing that. John, yep. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
My name is Eric LeMay for the New Books Network, and you've been listening to an interview with neuroanthropologist John S. Allen, author of The Omnivorous Mind, Our Evolving Relationship to Food.